From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we dispel some myths about the homeless. Joel Blau spent years working on the homeless problem for the city of New York, but left that job when he decided that the city's approach was all wrong. He's written a new book about the causes of homelessness called The Visible Poor. Also today, we meet Lawrence Block, the author of the Matt Scudder detective novels. Scudder used to be a hard-drinking private eye, but for the last few books, he's been sober. He's a loner who's had to rely on AA support groups. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new TV documentary on the history of the MGM studios. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A key Senate supporter of Israel said today that it appears that Israel's request for $10 billion in American loan guarantees is dead. Senators Patrick Leahy and Bob Casten met today with President Bush in an effort to work out a compromise on the issue. After that meeting, President Bush reiterated his determination not to grant the loan guarantees unless Israel halts new settlements in the occupied territories. The president said he didn't regard the issue as dead. Senator Leahy called the loan guarantees dead as of today, but said he'd go back to Congress to seek a further compromise. In Michigan, precincts across the state are reporting light voter turnout for today's presidential primary. President Bush and Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton are heavy favorites in the state. Don Gagne reports.
An election official in the Detroit suburb of Macomb County described the turnout as being, quote, embarrassingly low, though there is hope that things will pick up before the polls close at 8 tonight. The official said one reason for the low turnout could be that the Michigan primary is semi-closed, with Democratic voters having to sign a form declaring their party preference before entering the voting booth. Some have said they resent having to publicly state their party preference. Latest polls in the state show George Bush and Bill Clinton with sizable leads in their respective parties, but a lower-than-expected turnout could help former California Governor Jerry Brown score a solid second-place finish ahead of Paul Tsongas. Brown, who spent the morning shaking hands outside a General Motors plant slated to be shut down, is counting on local union officials who are mounting get-out-the-vote efforts on his behalf. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Many of South Africa's 3.2 million eligible white voters turned out to vote today in a referendum on constitutional reform. President F.W. de Klerk called the referendum to decide once and for all whether most whites there are behind the political reforms he launched 2 years ago. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports from Johannesburg.
What makes the pro-reform politicians optimistic tonight is what appears to be the high percentage of whites who came out to vote, up to 80% in some areas. The thinking had been that many whites who basically support reform but who are unhappy about a poor economy, high crime, and ongoing political violence might simply stay at home. So a larger voter turnout, say analysts, means more yes votes. There had been concern that paramilitary groups such as the far-right Afrikaner resistance movement would disrupt voting, and the National Party complained that some armed AWB men did show up at one polling station. But throughout the country, voting went peacefully, with voters lining up before dawn in many towns and standing patiently in long lines to make their views known. What those views are won't be known until tomorrow when the government releases the results. In Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 20 points to close at 3,256. This is NPR. Argentine President Carlos Menem blamed a terrorist attack for the explosion that destroyed the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires today. At least 10 people are reported to have been killed, including some children, possibly from a nearby elementary school. More than 105 people are said to have been injured. Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy said that the explosion was caused by a car bomb. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. officials told a Senate committee today there's no confirmation former Soviet scientists or engineers are working for countries that want nuclear weapons. They also deny any former Soviet missiles or technologies have been transferred to third parties. This follows weekend news reports in the U.S. and Europe that Iran bought two nuclear warheads from a former Soviet republic. More from NPR's Ann Garrels.
Despite what U.S. officials call alarming reports, they said today there is no evidence to confirm them. In Moscow, senior military officers were even more matter-of-fact. They claimed that every one of the Commonwealth's thousands of nuclear weapons could be accounted for and that none had been lost or stolen. Robert Gallucci is in charge of coordinating efforts to create a center to provide jobs for Russian scientists who might otherwise be tempted to sell their talents overseas. Gallucci noted today efforts to prevent a brain drain of top Russian weapons developers had focused on the scientists while ignoring the technicians who actually fabricate the nuclear weapons. Gallucci told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, "We should have somebody look at this." I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said today that the United States is still committed to using United Nations diplomacy to eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Cheney told reporters at the Pentagon that the U.S. still has a significant military capability in the Persian Gulf region, but believes the issue should be handled by the U.N. Security Council. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's frightening to think how adjusted we've become to stepping around people living on city streets, men and women whose only home is a cardboard box or a dirty wet blanket. More and more people are becoming homeless, and we don't seem to be any closer to reversing this dehumanizing trend. My guest Joel Blau is a former policy analyst for the New York City agency which runs the homeless shelters for the city's single adults. He was sure the city was taking the wrong approach to homelessness, so he quit. He says myths about the homeless are leading to misguided policies. He hopes to dispel some of those myths in his new book. Blau is now an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His new book is called The Visible Poor. And it's certainly true that with the homeless camped out in the streets, poverty is no longer hidden in America.
People, at least in the 1980s, didn't want to be bothered with any evidence that Reagan economics was not working the way President Reagan and Republican domestic policy people said it was. We were in the full flush of what was supposed to be an economic boom, and any evidence on the street of people who were so desperately poor that they had to exhibit their poverty in public was very unseemly and disorienting. It went against everything we were told in the media. Poverty that people see makes passersby very uncomfortable. And I think that accounts for a lot of the power of homelessness as a social issue, because it creates all sorts of feelings in people, the feeling of failure, of contempt for the failure, the feeling of the inadequacy of my giving a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar, the feeling of there but for the grace of God go I. And I suggest in the book that it's the power of these emotions that frame the social policies that we have developed. And I would argue that most of the social policies have targeted not the real causes of homelessness, but getting the homeless off the streets and out of public view.
You want your book to dispel some myths about who is homeless today. Let's start with the fact that you think that the proportion of the mentally ill homeless has been exaggerated according to the research you've done.
That's right. The proportions have been exaggerated for a number of reasons. First of all, to start with the issue of deinstitutionalization as a cause, two-thirds of the people in mental hospitals in this country were deinstitutionalized by 1972. Therefore, it's impossible to ascribe to deinstitutionalization the proliferation of homelessness 10 years later. Secondly, there is this whole issue of how the mental health field goes about diagnosing people and labeling them mentally ill. I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, according to the prime reference book of the American Psychiatric Association, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the way where most diagnoses come from, if you eat out of a garbage can, you are a schizophrenic. That is, you have one of the residual symptoms of schizophrenia. Now, a psychiatrist might look at that and with tunnel vision say, that person eating out of the garbage can is schizophrenic. A sociologist might look at that same person and say, perhaps that person is hungry. So that unless these labels are used with some sensitivity to the social context in which they're being employed, what you get is a psychiatrization of an entire population. And the same thing is true. There's also a diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual called Antisocial Personality Disorder. Antisocial Personality Disorder has its one of its prime attributes not having an address for 1 month or more, which most homeless people would immediately qualify merely by being homeless. So you have this commingling of what I would argue are primarily economic factors with a whole series of psychological factors, and the result is that an entire class of people have been labeled as dysfunctional, psychiatrically dysfunctional, in a way that I don't think takes into account the economic damage that has been done to them merely by their status of being homeless.
Well, what you're saying isn't to make light of the number of people who are mentally ill and homeless. What percentage would you say they probably make up of the homeless population?
Well, I would say that about 25 to 30% of the population is emotionally disturbed, but once again, I would caution to be very careful in analyzing what the relationship is between those kinds of diagnoses and the economic and effects of their status as being homeless people.
Another myth that you want to dispel is that drugs and alcohol are primary causes of homelessness. They're not.
Well, I think there are symptoms of homelessness. In the early part of the 20th century, the temperance movement tried to argue that if poor people were not subject to alcohol and didn't drink so much, they would no longer be poor. I think poor people were poor in the turn of the century and, you know, ethnic communities, industrial working people, because they weren't paid enough. And they drank because it was social and it helped to ease the pain. I think someday we'll come to look upon the notion that drugs or mental illness caused homelessness as another example of the longstanding American tradition of using a personal defect to explain the spread of poverty.
You're in fact suspicious of some uses of demographic data about the homeless population. What are your concerns?
My concerns are that on the one hand, demographic data is very useful for designing programs. It makes a big difference whether homeless people are people who've recently lost their jobs or people who are primarily mentally ill. But beyond that point of some kind of basic characterizations, we tend in this country to be almost obsessional about getting the last number and getting the last category correct, you know, down to the last person. And I think this is part of the American tradition to try to explain away structural problems. If people are poor, that's must because they are different from us. And if we do the demographic analysis, then we can find out in what way they are different from us. If we can find out that there's a high prevalence of mental illness, then, well, we're not mentally ill. That must be the explanation why they're homeless. If they have drugs, well, we don't use drugs. Therefore, that must be the explanation of why they're homeless. And that has a longstanding tradition in it. And it concerns me because my basic feeling is that people have common human needs and homelessness is a consequence of things that have happened to them which have more to do with political and economic causes than they do with another set of social problems that have become commingled with those political and economic causes, such as lack of money and things like that.
You think that it's very important to understand the causes of homelessness in order to be able to solve the problem of homelessness. You have what I thought was a very interesting analysis of our philosophy of welfare. What you say in your book basically is that the philosophy in the United States of welfare is that welfare has to pay less than a job would. And lately, welfare has paid so little that it's not enough to rent a house or to rent an apartment with.
Yeah, the principle that I describe in the book is what we, what people talk about all the time. They say things like, well, you know, work has to pay more than welfare or why would anyone bother to work? What happened, I think, over the last 15 years is that as wages have either held constant or declined, in order to keep welfare below the lower rung of wages, welfare has gone down too. So that, for example, the median state in this country, Illinois, lost 42% of the value of its welfare grant between 1970 and 1991. So that welfare grant, I think, pays like $367 a month for three people, a mother and two children. And there's no way you can sustain yourself on that kind of money in Illinois. And it's one of the reasons why people are really suffering. If wages go down and welfare goes down and housing goes up, you're left with an affordability gap that is, in my judgment, the prime reason why so many people have become homeless.
So you think the prime reasons for homelessness is unemployment, low wages, low welfare, and hard-to-find low-rent housing?
That's right. Now, everything that people often mistake, in my view, for the real causes, such as the drugs and the mental illness, then get overlaid onto that. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish a symptom from a cause, but I would say that those are really symptoms and not causes.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joel Blau. He's an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and author of a new book about homelessness. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Joel Blau is my guest. He's author of the new book, The Visible Poor. It's about homelessness in America. Do you think that in trying to find solutions to homelessness in America, we have created some solutions that have really made the problem worse?
Yes. Rather than provide permanent housing, we would waste and have wasted thousands of dollars a month on major welfare hotels and family shelters in most American cities. Rather than provide people with real jobs that pay real wages, we have wasted money on all sorts of temporary provisions for income. We need a program in this country that really makes people productive, that enables them to support a family, and enables them to have the social supports they need when they have trouble. And all of us at some time or another in our lives are going to have difficulty about something, whether it's an illness or a loss of a job, whatever it is.
What would you address first, the lack of short-term shelter space or the social and economic problems that lay behind homelessness?
I hope I don't have to choose.
Right.
Well, I think the first thing I would do, I would hope, would be to ensure that there was permanent shelter.
As opposed to temporary shelter.
As opposed to temporary shelter. I think we need a program of a nonprofit permanent housing in this country, which would not be subject to real estate appreciation, so that if you got a house and stayed in it and then left, that would be returned to the nonprofit community agency that owned it. And that you couldn't resell it for a profit. That seems to me the best way to create a social sector for housing. On the longer term kinds of policies, we need the usual shopping list. It's things like national health insurance, the provision of daycare so that people can work, wages that were large enough to support a family. We've shortchanged the entire American population terribly about these needs over the last 10 or 15 years.
You know, I have to compliment you in talking about the kind of housing you'd like to see. You use the phrase nonprofit permanent housing, thus very cleverly getting around the expression public housing.
Of course it is. I mean, public housing is...
It has a terrible reputation.
And it was, I think, inevitable that it gained such a reputation because the same principle that applies to the labor market where welfare has to pay less than work also applies to public housing. You could not build attractive public housing in this country because that would intrude upon what is thought of as a prerogative of the real estate market, namely the real estate industry, namely to create private housing for profit. If you did a really successful, attractive public housing project and didn't have a need standard to get in there, people would say, well, why can't we have that? So I think that it was set up to so that housing for the poor would necessarily be poor housing. And when I say nonprofit social sector for housing, I mean something that would not have a means test that would be available to everybody. And that would, in fact, be something that the ordinary working person would be perfectly happy to live in.
Now, you said that cheap housing should be available without having to prove financial need. But I think some people would argue that people who might want to save money but could afford better would use this housing. And since the units are limited, that would be depriving people who couldn't possibly afford better of using this housing.
What I'm talking about is the creation of a social sector which doesn't make distinctions between who needs it and who doesn't. For example, in England before Thatcher, public housing was simply public housing. It was another, you know, there was private housing and there was public housing. You could try to get an apartment in one kind of housing or try to get an apartment in another without having to prove that you lack sufficient income. The issue that you're raising is an important one in the sense that there's always a trade-off between the adequacy of universal programs for everybody and targeted programs that are based on a means test or lacking a certain level of income. And I'm suggesting that what we need to do in the housing field is provide housing that's for everybody, and then we won't have to make the distinctions about whether somebody is sufficiently desperate.
One of the changes we saw in a lot of cities in the 70s and 80s was gentrification that basically got rid of the Skid Row areas of cities, the areas in which there were really cheap hotels, flop houses, cheap housing. What impact do you think that that's had on the larger problem of homelessness? Has it been very significant?
That's been of enormous significance. The effect of this, some million units of SRO housing across the country in, from 1970 into the early 80s has been considerable. The fact is that the casual laborers, the people who were vulnerable, who were housed in places that charged relatively small amounts per month, no longer have a place to go. And they constitute a significant part of the population.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Blau, and he's the author of a new book on homelessness in America called The Visible Poor. You used to be a policy advisor to the part of the city that oversaw shelters in New York. And you've seen a lot of the shelters in New York. You've also, I believe, traveled around the country and visited a lot of shelters there. Can you give me an example of what you've seen of a shelter that epitomizes what's wrong with the shelter system? And then maybe one that is a very good example of one of the best shelters you've seen.
Well, the worst shelters are probably the large armories in New York, for example, the Fort Washington Armory in New York, which is two football fields long. It was used for the National Guard to train. And if you stand on the balcony above the drill floor, you can see two football fields of cots laid side by side, 900, sometimes as many as 1,200 people. The same dynamics that occur in any institution that is that large occur in a shelter of that sort. Drugs begin to proliferate. People become hopeless. There's crime. There's violence. It's a terrible way to house people, and one that's absolutely certain to increase the difficulties of the homeless problem. The best shelters, I'm not sure that I could think of one in a specific place, but they they tend to be smaller. 25 people, I think, is sort of the best judgment about how large you can get without beginning to precipitate some of the dynamics of a large institution. They have social services in the shelter, a job training program and referrals in the shelter. There's I think, some shelters in Los Angeles that do that. There are some smaller voluntary shelters that do that, but there are few and far between.
I wonder if you think any of the presidential candidates are saying anything of substance about homelessness.
I don't think so. I thought that Harkin would, but I think what most of them have decided tactically is that they should talk about the middle class rather than the poor. The 84 and 88 elections were conducted about the poor, and they were lost. And so I think people, the presidential candidates, have decided to focus on the middle class. And I think that the Democratic Party needs to walk on two legs. It needs to try to develop a coalition of both poor and middle class people organized around common human needs through universal social programs, and that those are the programs and those are the ways, and that's the coalition that will return a progressive Democrat to the White House.
You know, in some perverse way, one good thing about how visible the homeless are, how many homeless are living in the streets of the cities, is that it makes it a middle class issue. Because people going to work, people living in the city, people living in the city, no matter how wealthy they are, have to deal with homelessness. And it's everybody's issue because of that.
That's right. I mean, I think that part of the 1980s, people believed that they could get wealthy and they could have their sort of castle and moat mentality. You know, you could hole yourself up in a luxury building in the central city, and while it's true you might have to step over a few bodies on the way to work, that somehow you would be immune from what was going on around you. And I think that what's happened over the last couple of years, particularly with the recession, is it's demonstrated that what happened in the 80s disguised changes in income with an enormous shift of income upward, and that in some sense homelessness in the 1970s or early 80s is sort of the modern equivalent of Song of the Canary in the mines, where if the canary dies and the miners know they're in trouble because the gas is loose, the fact that homeless people were out on the street is a sign, was the first sign, I would argue, of a decline in our standard of living, because poor people used to be housed even if they were poor. Now poor people are homeless, and as their standard of living has declined, I would argue people good ways up the income scale, their standard of living has declined as well.
Well, Joel Blau, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Joel Blau is the author of the new book, The Visible Poor. It's about homelessness in America, and it's just been published by Oxford University Press. Blau is an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Matt Scudder is a tough private eye and a recovering alcoholic, trying to deal both with killers and his drinking problem. Scudder is the creation of crime novelist Lawrence Block. Coming up, we talk with the author of 8 Million Ways to Die and A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. This weekend, the TNT cable network begins an 8-hour documentary on the MGM movie studios. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Polls close in Illinois and most of Michigan 1/2 hour from now in primaries where jobs and trade are big issues. Bill Clinton hopes to add 294 delegates in the Democratic presidential race, and Jerry Brown hopes for a second-place finish in Michigan, while Paul Tsongas is already looking ahead to next week's primary in Connecticut. President Bush is looking for wins in both primary states against challenger Patrick Buchanan. John Dempsey of member station WBEZ reports from Chicago.
It's an old Chicago saying that all politics is local, and today is no exception. As Illinois voters choose among the different presidential candidates, the emphasis among Chicago precinct captains and ward bosses is on a referendum that decides a new ward map for the Chicago City Council. It's also a Chicago tradition to have problems at the polling places. There have been a number of reports of irregularities and polling places not opening on time. Illinois Democrats are also casting ballots in a hotly contested three-way primary for U.S. Senate, as incumbent Alan Dixon faces millionaire personal injury attorney Al Hofeld and Carol Mosley Braun, a black woman who's a former Illinois state legislative leader. For National Public Radio, I'm John Dempsey in Chicago.
Three members of the president's cabinet admitted today that they unknowingly wrote bad checks on their accounts at the House Bank when they were members of Congress. Secretary of Agriculture Edward Madigan said that he wrote 49 overdrafts, Secretary of Labor Lynn Martin 16, and Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney as many as 25. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
All three cabinet officers said they didn't know they'd issued bad checks and had never been notified of any overdraft while they were in the House. Secretary Cheney told a Pentagon news conference he was so sure his account was clear, he'd made jokes about the issue in a speech last Thursday.
I began my remarks by saying that it is difficult to be Secretary of Defense at a time when we are cutting the defense budget. But I said things could be worse. I could still be a member of Congress with an account in the House Bank. Doesn't seem quite as funny today.
Cheney said he was angry and frustrated to find himself lumped together with those who'd knowingly abused the House Bank to get interest-free loans, but while he blamed the Democratic leadership of the House, today's admissions are likely to blunt Republican efforts to exploit the House Bank as a partisan political issue. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
And the government says that home construction jumped 9.6% last month to its highest point in nearly 2 years. Construction was up the most in the Middle West, followed by higher construction in the West. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 20 points to close at 3,256.04. On volume of some 187 million shares, trading was active. This is NPR News. In Argentina, an explosion ripped through the Israeli embassy in downtown Buenos Aires. Officials say at least 10 people were killed and more than 100 others were injured. At the time of the blast, up to 150 people were said to be inside the building. President Carlos Menem called the blast a terrorist attack. He said that there are no prime suspects in the bombing, which he said had been carried out by an international terrorist group with the help of terrorists inside his country. He said that airport security has been increased. In Moscow, several thousand protesters rallied, but the protest fell far short of the huge rally that organizers had planned to protest economic reforms of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The crowd of some 20,000 brought together old communists and nationalists and even some monarchists, all united for the moment in their opposition to the economic policies of Boris Yeltsin. But despite the speeches and chants and red flags, the opposition to Yeltsin was unable to bring the 100,000 or more protesters it had claimed into the streets of Moscow. Earlier, the defunct Soviet Congress of People's Deputies, the parliament of the Soviet Union that disbanded in December, attempted to reconvene itself and challenge the authority of the Russian parliament. But the handful of representatives willing to hold the Congress were unable to find a suitable meeting place in Moscow and finally settled for a farm about 30 miles outside the capital. Today's protests reveal the current weakness of the organized opposition to Yeltsin's policies. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In London, Buckingham Palace has declined to comment on a report in the Daily Mail newspaper that Prince Andrew and his wife, the Duchess of York, are getting ready to announce their separation. The newspaper says that the Queen's attorney discussed what it called tangled legal issues with the couple last Sunday. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against major foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Usually when I go on vacation, I read books by dead authors so I won't be distracted by thoughts of what I would ask them in an interview. But on my recent vacation, I read a book by the very much alive Lawrence Block, a detective writer who had come highly recommended. I liked the novel so much that in spite of being on vacation, I all too predictably started planning an interview. Well, we recorded the interview earlier today. Block has written close to 10 novels about Matt Scudder, a private eye whose turf is Manhattan. Scudder is a former cop who quit the force after he accidentally shot and killed a teenager. He's left his wife, two kids, and home in the suburbs, and now lives alone in a small, dingy hotel room. The latest Scudder novel was published last year. The one I read on vacation, 8 Million Ways to Die, came out in 1982. This moody novel was a turning point for Scudder. After years of hard drinking, he tries staying sober and joins AA. It's not easy for this cynical loner to feel at home in a support group, as you'll hear in this reading.
I got to the meeting a couple of minutes early. Half a dozen people said hello to me by name. I got some coffee and sat down. The speaker told an abbreviated drinking story and spent most of the time telling of all the things that had happened to him since he got sober 4 years ago. His marriage had broken up, his youngest son had been killed by a hit-and-run driver, he'd gone through a period of extended unemployment and several bad bouts of clinical depression. I wanted to leave at the break. Instead, I got a cup of coffee and took a couple of Fig Newtons. I ate the cookies. It was like chewing straw, but I chewed them and washed them down. During the discussion, one woman got into a long riff about her relationship. She was a pain in the ass. She said the same thing every night. I tuned out. I thought, my name is Matt and I'm an alcoholic. A woman I know got killed last night. She hired me to keep her from getting killed, and I wound up assuring her that she was safe and she believed me. And her killer conned me and I believed him, and she's dead now and there's nothing I can do about it. And it eats at me, and I don't know what to do about that. And there's a bar on every corner and a liquor store on every block. And drinking won't bring her back to life, but neither will staying sober. And why the hell do I have to go through this? Why? I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and we sit around in these goddamned rooms and say the same damn things all the time. And meanwhile, out there, all the animals are killing each other. We say don't drink and go to meetings, and we say the important thing is you're sober, and we say easy does it, and we say one day at a time, and while we natter on like brainwashed zombies, the world is coming to an end. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and I need help. When they got to me, I said, my name is Matt. Thanks for your qualification. I enjoyed it. I think I'll just listen tonight.
Lawrence Block, thanks for reading that passage from 8 Million Ways to Die. You know, having your main character, Matthew Scudder, having given up alcohol creates this intense mood of constant craving for what he can't have. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, life is kind of drained of color and meaning during these periods when he's really craving alcohol. I guess what got you thinking about how you could use that in the novel?
Well, the Matthew Scudder series of books evolved gradually. 8 Million Ways to Die was the fifth book in the series. And in the first three books, he's a hard drinker who doesn't really pay much mind to the effects or implications of his drinking. And when I started writing the books, I fully intended that he would stay like that forever. Most series detectives certainly are static characters. They don't change much. That's always been the case. And I found, as the series progressed, the fourth book was called A Stab in the Dark, and in that one he's beginning to see that there's something pathological about his drinking but doesn't really want to look at it. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, that was a pivotal book in which his struggles with his alcoholism and his being forced to come to terms with that are really as much a part of the book as is the solution of a crime.
I find it interesting, you know, that you've taken this character who loves hanging out at bars, and a lot of his sources are at bars, and he even goes to bars after joining AA because that's kind of where he lives. I wonder, well, I should ask you first if you had a problem with alcohol and if you had to give it up and if you're writing out of a first-person knowledge about some of these things.
Well, I don't like to talk about that too much, but I will say that I used to drink rather the way Scudder did, and I don't drink anymore.
Do you still hang out in bars? I mean, is there something about bars that you like very much in spite of the fact that you can partake of the alcohol?
No, not particularly. My own experience is that bar conversation that may have seemed fascinating and stimulating years ago seemed to require a fairly high blood level of alcohol in order to be all that absorbing.
So why does your character keep going back?
Well, he there's only really one bar that he hangs out at a lot, and that's because of a particular relationship he has with a fellow he met. Yeah, I should probably say that I thought the books were going to end with 8 Million Ways to Die. That seemed to be a catharsis in the character's life, and I thought, gee, there's no place to go after this. His detra has lost its raison. You know, he's still a detective, but you know, let him go get a life on his own time. But it turned out that I liked the character a lot. I liked seeing the world through those particular eyes and I did write further books about it. There have now been, I think the 10th is going to be coming out in September, called A Walk Among the Tombstones.
The neighborhood that is your detective's territory is Manhattan, the upper 50s, the far west side, 9th Avenue, 10th Avenue.
Right.
How did that become your neighborhood as a writer?
Well, I was living there when I first started writing about Scudder. In fact, I was living on the same block, though not in a hotel. I had an apartment on that block and hung out at a lot of the places that he hung out at in the early books, most of which, I might add, are gone now. The neighborhood has changed, and there's been the usual kind of attrition with commercial establishments, so that it's hard to find a lot of Scudder's old haunts.
I used to house at an apartment that was right next door to Polly's Cage, which is a
bar, yes,
that Scudder used to hang out at, and it's now a kind of a cafe restaurant.
Right. It looks very yuppie now. Wasn't it a tacky place? It was.
Oh,
it was
sure
marvelous.
Was. So you watch your old neighborhood get gentrified. Do you still live there?
No, I live down in the Village. Uh-huh. I have for a few years now.
You actually moved out of New York for a couple of years.
Yes. Yes.
Why did you leave?
It's hard to remember. It was a vastly failed experiment. We moved down to the Gulf Coast of Florida for a stretch, and we did not transplant well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lawrence Block, and he writes the series of detective novels featuring Matthew Scudder, and his latest is called A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Lawrence Block is my guest. Let me get back to 8 Million Ways to Die.
Sure.
Again for a second. You know, the main character keeps reading the New York Daily News, and every day there's another really gruesome murder that's taken place that's in the headlines. And that's where the title 8 Million Ways to Die comes
right.
from. Because for each person in New York, there's another way of possibly...
Mm-hmm.
being murdered or killed. Are you what's your reaction when you read that stuff in the paper?
Well, it was interesting, and that particular book, when I was writing that, I was living up in Washington Heights at that particular time, and I would do my day's work, and then I would leave the house generally late afternoon, pick up a copy of the news, and get on the subway and ride downtown. And the horrible stories that Scudder dutifully reports each time were the ones that I'd read the night before and that I then would write about. You know, the city never failed to provide heinous atrocities for me to report in the next day's writing. It was quite bizarre.
Yeah, I want to get back to your travels. You've lived in New York, moved to Florida for 2 years. After Florida, I think you just picked up stakes, and you and your wife drove around the country for 2 years.
We spent 2 years living without a fixed address, yes.
And just to give it a sense of structure, I think, you decided to visit every town named Buffalo that you could find in the country. And
yes, we did. I had grown up in Buffalo, New York, and I had discovered in the course of some research for another book that there were more towns named Buffalo than I had realized, that there were indeed about 20 of them. And I said to my wife, we should go to some of these. And my wife, who is at least as deranged as I am, drew herself up very straight and said, I think we should go to all of them. So we began attempting to do that and discovered almost similarly to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that simply the act of looking for buffaloes caused more to appear. We have now, at this count, we've been to 63 and know of another 20. So the original 20 has grown to somewhere in the 80s, and I have a feeling that this will just go on forever. It's like looking for subatomic particles.
Did this turn out to be a pointless exercise or an interesting one?
A friend of mine, a singer named Tom Bishop, heard the story, and I said, I think it's really pretty pointless. And he said, I don't know. It makes as much sense as golf. So it gave a structure to things. It gave us a reason to turn left rather than right when we got to an intersection, and it facilitated a wonderful rambling couple of years. And we're by no means done. We intend to keep on as long as there's another buffalo.
Do you feel that the detective genre has changed in the years that you've been writing in it?
Yes, I do think so. I think one big change is that the books now tend to be a lot more about the detectives than they used to.
As opposed to about the murder and the plot and the whodunit aspect.
Right. Right. Classic hard-boiled works, for example, we learn very little about Philip Marlowe or Lou Archer or the Continental Op. We know very little about them, and we don't learn more and more as we read additional books, nor do they change. They don't really have a life. This isn't much the case with most of what's being written now. And if one were taking a dim view of this, you could call it the soap operaization of the category, in that readers want to know what happens in the life of the character. And writers seem to be inclined to write that. Certainly, the Scudder novels are about Scudder, just as they're about the solution of a crime.
I think in a lot of ways the crime genre has become the genre that really tries to be about character, a sense of place, and a sense of contemporary life, too, because the detective is always very observant and is observing how people are living today.
I think so. It's somehow had this mantle placed at its disposal because I think so much of contemporary mainstream fiction has become about less and less. Not merely minimalist work, but a lot of books are about themselves or are about writing or are about language rather than being about what books traditionally were about, which was their story and their characters.
A lot of despair in a lot of crime fiction, in part because the detective is often lonely and is exposed to the most brutal aspects of society. And I'd say probably not so much in the more recent stuff, but, you know, Scudder has dealt with his share of despair. There must be something about that kind of mood that you personally respond to.
Oh, sure. I don't always walk along humming, you know, but I think this is a hard world, and most people have a great deal of grief in their lives, you know, and I don't feel it's my mission solely to reflect that in my work, and a lot of my work is quite lighthearted. Certainly there's a series of books I did about a burglar named Bernie Rodenbaugh, which they're also set in New York, and it's a different New York from the one that that Scudder lives in. The streets are the same, but the feel is different.
Does it ever feel odd to you that the character you've created is always having these life-endangering adventures while you're almost always sitting home and typing?
Well, no, I haven't thought about that much. I suppose in certain respects, Scudder's life is more interesting and dramatic than mine, but otherwise he'd be sitting around writing about me.
Lawrence Block's latest novel is A Dance at the Slaughterhouse. This is Fresh Air. There are primaries today in Illinois and Michigan, and Linda Wertheimer is in Chicago to co-anchor All Things Considered from there. Linda, what are you reporting on?
We're watching the vote and waiting for the results, Terry, and covering a story at the Projects in Chicago, some young women who are trying to take control of their lives through a program called Mama Said. Ira Glass is following volunteers at Bill Clinton's Illinois headquarters. And we are also watching the election in South Africa. There's more on the banking story. The House Bank, now cabinet secretaries, have gotten into the act. We're watching that and loan guarantees to Israel.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday, Ted Turner's TNT cable network launches an 8-hour documentary called MGM, When the Lion Roars. It's a look at the history of one of Hollywood's major movie studios, a studio whose entire inventory of films just happens to be owned by Turner. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
This could have gone either way. It doesn't bother me that the company that owns the rights to the MGM films is making a documentary about it. In fact, when the TNT network was launched a few years ago, its first original production was a documentary about the making of Gone with the Wind, and it was brilliant. Besides, the TNT-MGM connection means the makers of MGM, When the Lion Roars, would have unlimited access to clips from any MGM movie, access that no other documentary producers could afford to buy. So with the right approach, this massive project could be a film lover's dream. Unfortunately, it's more like a nightmare. The director and co-writer of When the Lion Roars is Frank Martin, and the producer is Joni Levin. Their joint credits are overwhelmingly unimpressive and include such insightful documentaries as The Making of RoboCop and The Making of 52 Pickup. Instead of being made by film historians, When the Lion Roars is a product by glorified marketers and publicists. This explains why the whole project is maddeningly corporate. It looks at everything from the top down and gives more credit to the studio heads than the filmmakers and judges movies not by their content, but by their shooting ratios, profit margins, and box office receipts. When actor Jackie Cooper discusses Woody Van Dyke, a director so cost-conscious he was given the nickname One Take, this program considers that nickname not an insult, but a virtue.
No matter what the film was, or what part of the world they were going to make it in, or what the budget was, Woody was going to bring it in on or under budget. He knew that's how you stay alive at MGM, and that's how you get very popular with Mr. Mayor. It better be pretty good, too, but more important, it better be on budget.
Not only is the focus of this historical overview all wrong, but it's totally out of context. Actors like Buster Keaton and W.C. Fields seemingly come from nowhere, make a few films at MGM, then vanish. There's no sense of the overall history of Hollywood, only of MGM's share of the pie. And it wasn't always the lion's share. Worst of all, though, is this documentary's packaging. The host is Patrick Stewart of Star Trek The Next Generation, whose wonderful way with dialogue saves his speeches from seeming even more silly than they are. However, even Stewart is done in by the fancy sets and mood music, and by a loud approach that makes it seem like he's talking from a bad long-distance phone connection on some Hollywood holodeck. In this case, from the back of a backlot steam train.
At least once a week, Irving, Margaret Booth, Sam Marks, a handful of executives, and occasionally L.B. Mayer himself, would board the MGM Special, the studio's plush private trolley car. And they would head for one of the smaller communities on the outskirts of Los Angeles. There they would hold sneak previews of upcoming pictures. The theater audience would be asked to fill out response cards, and according to their suggestion, scenes from the picture would be re-edited or even reshot.
And how can you forgive a show that gets excited about the concept of audience testing? Yet that's just what this show does from start to finish. In fact, when it gets to the 60s, with David Lean making Dr. Zhivago and Stanley Kubrick making 2001 A Space Odyssey, there's grudging acknowledgement of the singular visions of those directors, but a lot of complaining that the front office had been cut out of the filmmaking process. MGM When the Lion Roars looks like it came straight from the front office and should never have left there. Film fans will want to watch it anyway to catch some rare backstage footage and interviews, and just to catch all the movie clips. But don't accept any of this as objective or even good film history. It's promotion, pure and simple. Well, maybe not so pure, but definitely simple.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with actress Judy Davis, star of the films Naked Lunch, Impromptu, and My Brilliant Career. Also, documentary filmmaker Barbara Koppel on American Dream, her Oscar-winning film about the Hormel meatpacker strike. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.